Hello, and welcome to the March 26, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is New York-based jazz pianist, composer, arranger, band leader, and educator, Kaylee O'Doherty. New York-based pianist, composer, arranger, and educator Kaylee O'Doherty is known for integrating structures of language in both her compositions and her approach to improvisation. Her recent music focuses on the celebration, preservation, and expansion upon the achievements of jazz's unsung women heroes. O'Doherty has received national awards for piano performance and composition from the ASCAP Foundation and Downbeat magazine. Praised by All About Jazz for its exquisitely forged, dramatic, and darkly hued pieces, O'Doherty's debut release, Podme, in 2015, uses lyrics to give the melodies a natural rhythm of language. Podme was selected as a Downbeat magazine editor's pick and received a 4-star review in All About Jazz. The latest release from O'Doherty is Quarantine Dream on the Positone Records label, released in 2022. The album release was followed by a United States CD release tour with support from a Jazz Road grant from South Arts. The Kaylee O'Doherty Quintet was selected by the United States Department of State as one of 10 ensembles to participate in the 2022-2023 American Music Abroad United States State Department Tour of the Republic of Georgia and Canada. Also, in 2022, O'Doherty was one of 10 artists to receive a Chamber Music America New Jazz Works grant, which funds the creation of a new original work. In 2021, O'Doherty received a Chamber Music America Presenters Consortium for Jazz grant to present her project, Kaylee O'Doherty, Celebrating Lil Hardin Armstrong, featuring her arrangements of compositions by pianist, composer, and vocalist Lil Hardin Armstrong. She has performed at the Kimmel Center, San Francisco Jazz, Jazz at Lincoln Center, Panama Jazz Festival, Guinness Cork Jazz Festival, concert halls throughout China, and UNESCO First International Jazz Day in Paris, as well as 2 United States State Department supported tours to Colombia and Togo and Benin in West Africa. O'Doherty is currently on the faculty at Purchase College School of the Arts Conservatory of Music. Additionally, she is on the faculty at Jazz House Kids and Savannah Music Festival Jazz Academy. She leads educational performances in New York City schools about jazz, democracy, and civil rights as a band leader for jazz at Lincoln Center's Jazz for Young People program. O'Doherty has been a faculty member at the Stanford Jazz Workshop since 2012, as well as faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Summer Music Clinic and Litchfield Jazz Camp. She is a graduate of Berklee College of Music with a Bachelor of Music in 2013 and the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queens College with a Master's of Music degree in 2019. Kaylee O'Doherty is a Nord keyboard artist. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Kaylee O'Doherty. Hello, Kaylee.
Hi.
It's really great to talk with you and to have you as a guest today on my show. One of the things that I'm curious about is that you do a lot of original composition, and you have won numerous awards for your pieces. Would you tell us about some of your more recent compositions that have come to be recognized?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show, Craig. I'm looking forward to our conversation. And my most recent body of work that I have written was composed in August and September of 2023. And that's a suite that I wrote for my mom. It's called Suite for Grojean. It's a 13-part suite of compositions. They're all original compositions that we're actually going to go into the studio and record at the end of this month. And then that music is going to be released in 2025. The suite was part of a commission, a grant that I received from Chamber Music America. It's called the New Jazz Works Grant. And so we premiered this music a few times in 2023. And now we're going to document it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I know there was, because I put the link to it in my show notes, but a performance that you did that was recorded and put on YouTube.
Yes.
And so we can kind of get a sneak preview from that, what's going to come out on the new album when it's released. But can you tell us a little bit about, the suite was named after your mother. So in what ways was your mother the inspiration?
Yeah, I was writing this suite. I had the idea to write a suite for her for many years. And I had actually written a piece. It's not included in this body of work because this commission is all brand new compositions. That was what the New Jazz Works grant funds. But my mom has been a huge influence in my life, and I like to think about music, even most recently since the pandemic, I would say, as just a very healing thing that we can use for, healing to ourselves, but also healing to other people. And my mom has been battling some illness for many, many years, and I was just thinking about creating a soundscape for her and, for this music to be kind of an expression and a process of that. And that even no matter what the listener is going through, that it could have some sort of impact on them and make them feel something that could be healing to them.
Well, I don't disagree with you that I think that music is the best therapy that we can have. Yeah. I think that's what helps me cope on a daily basis is, listening. But I'm really curious to know. So when you wrote these pieces, what came first? Was it a melodic idea or a rhythmic idea or a particular set of chord changes? Or did you start with maybe some made up
lyrics to kind of give your piece a theme. I know I've talked to some composers that will do that. They will, or maybe they'll use a poem or something that's written. It won't be actually in the context of the piece, but it's inspires the writing. Or, trying to find music that reflects a particular mood. What would you say is most frequent in your compositional process?
I would say I've tried all of those, and I love composing. I've been composing since I was 11 years old. So over the many years, I've kind of experimented with different types of inspiration, from writing lyrics and using language as a tool for improvising. I was really on that for a while. But for this specific suite, I was really just sitting down at the piano and experimenting. What was very freeing about this experience of writing was that the parameters, I kind of knew the parameter was to write a suite, and I knew that I wanted it to be one piece going into the next piece. So I kind of wrote it like that, with that in mind. So some of the pieces are actually quite short. They're just little themes, little melodies that are memorable, that aren't even meant to be improvised over or really played over for much more than an interlude. So I wrote it very much as this through composed body of work that will be listened to without breaks. So for this, I just was really thinking about melodies. Some of the material came across with chords. I'm a pianist, so oftentimes I'm just sitting at the piano noodling, and my compositions start from just coming across a shape or a chord voicing that's kind of unusual to me. And maybe that'll inspire, a little progression that I'll come up with. So I don't know, all different vehicles that I used to write this, but I would say in general, what was freeing was that I didn't feel pressured to use any specific compositional tool. I felt like whatever I was inspired to do, I kind of went with that. And that was very freeing to me, because in the past, I've tried many different parameters. I've said, like, oh, I'm going to write a specific form, a specific time signature, key signature with a specific feel. I want a bass line driven composition. I want, all these parameters that I had kind of pre-thought of as giving myself some structure of, how what to do. But this, I was just really seeing where my ear, brought me. So.
So it was really much more from an affective position than a cognitive one, would you
Yeah,
say?
definitely.
So the other thing that I find interesting is when you talk about the each of the pieces being interconnected. The first thing that came to my mind were the song cycles that many composers wrote in the 19th century, where I was thinking like Schubert's Winterreise, and all the songs are about winter. So in other words, around a common theme and seeming to or perhaps we could look at the pieces in your suite as like chapters from a novel or a book or something, and how they're all interconnected and expressing maybe a different kind of side to the musical personality that you are creating. The other thing that came to mind too is that I'm intrigued by a lot of the programs that are on a number of streaming services, particularly the mystery detective shows that are on. I mean, very much enjoy those because with each succeeding episode, they seem to, enlarge the keyhole that you're peering through, to get more and more of the story, more of the background, more of the understanding, which you don't necessarily have at the very beginning. Do you view your composition in this particular work in that way, that as we go through the different pieces, that we're getting a more full picture of your inspiration?
Yeah, I think you're going to hear my inspiration in the way that I write. I hope and I feel that I have a voice that is unique to my own, and that is being developed, has been developed, and is continued to develop all the time. But I kind of am into this idea right now, just in the for this body of work of just creating art that doesn't necessarily have to have, you know, every single individual piece has to have this deep story of, okay, this one time this thing happened and then it inspired this piece. I'm really thinking about just a soundscape, kind of like a film
Oh,
score.
sure.
And that transporting the listener into like a soundtrack that is healing to them.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to me telling them what the meaning was behind it and, you know, what they should be feeling from this and what experience I'm hoping for them to gather from listening to this song. I want them to come up with their own experience. I want to hear how it affects them in their own way, based on their own life. And I really do think music can have that. It can mean something completely different to me than it does to somebody else. And
yes.
I think when I listen to great music that I appreciate and that leaves a big impact on me, I know that what I'm getting out of it isn't what the composer was intending. You know, it's most likely something that they were thinking about that's completely different. And that's also fine. But I think a soundtrack, like I'm very into yoga and meditation and things like that. I think as jazz music has always been used as a vehicle for with a healing element, whether it was talking about the history of the times and, you know, helping deal with different issues throughout history, like racism and sexism and all these topics. But I think that theme continues to play out into modern jazz music, just as we're evolving with different, you know, different things that each of us are going through. So,
some of the things that you've just said inspired some of my memories of when I taught music appreciation at the university. And of course, most of the students you get into music appreciation class have very limited musical background. I mean, most of what they're exposed to is pop music with lyrics. And so, you know, you play a Chopin, prelude, and it has no lyric. And the big question, hand goes up, well, Dr. Hurst, what does it mean? And I would say, well, let's think about this in a couple of ways. Number one, what was the mindset of Chopin in the case of this piece? I said, when he wrote this piece, was he happy? Was he sad? Had he just had a fight with his, you know, with George Sand? Had he just gotten, something good, something bad? What was his emotion, do you think? Then I'd follow up and say, how does it make you feel? So that was one thing that came to mind. And then the other that just blared out of my head like a neon sign was Charlie Parker's quote, if you don't feel it, it'll never come out of your horn. And music is something that elicits emotion as well as reflects emotion. So it, like you said, as the composer, you could be reflecting a particular emotion of yours, but to the listener, it might elicit a completely different emotion in the listener. And that's okay, because music is, such a wonderfully plastic art that it can have that, flexibility. So I think it doesn't have to mean just one thing, Actually, neither does any great art, but, So that's really interesting.
And you touched upon something I just wanted to add to, which is
sure.
Like non-lyrical music, music that doesn't include lyrics, which is something that I'm very passionate about. I also love lyrics. I haven't had a lot of experience writing lyrics myself, but I love playing other music with other people's lyrics. But I think there's something very powerful to me as a listener and also as a composer and, performer of a lot of music that is sung or is played instrumentally, that it allows an interpretation that's much more free. And when you put lyrics on something, you're telling a specific story, which can be very powerful and impactful. But when you don't have lyrics, there's way more room for interpretation, and I like that freedom a lot. I love that in playing instrumental music. I love that in writing instrumental music, is that I feel like I can create my own story, my own narrative. I can give meaning to it that's completely my own, that isn't driven by somebody telling me what I should think about it, or it, I have a lot more freedom to kind of interpret it in my own. And I've always loved instrumental music. And so I think that's another element that kind of has to be in play, is I think, now we always try and market our music, for publicity and all these reasons where we say, like, it's very catchy to have a story, and for the song to have, be written about this one experience that you had that has a whole thing around it. And sometimes they do. And I've written many songs like that as well. And sometimes that they genuinely do have a deeper story, and that's great too. But I think sometimes it's just a feeling that you have. Like, sometimes I sit down and I write something and it makes me feel good, and it makes me feel, and it doesn't have anything more to it than that, other than, wow, this is really healing for me. I feel very good when I'm playing this song, or I'm in this mood, or this soundscape. And I think translating that is also powerful, that we don't have to tie everything up in a little bow and put all this, marketability behind something, but it can be more of like a fluid translation, just from a genuine place of, this is like a genuine experience that I'm having that I want to share with you, that I'm not going to label or tell you how you should be perceiving it or how you should be feeling from it, that you can have your own interpretation, but that hopefully it comes across that it's a genuine feeling from me to you that we can share.
I couldn't agree with you more, because I'm on that very much in that same page. And then to even take it one step further, then with the improvisatory aspects of jazz within the context of a performance, we add another layer of expression that is spontaneous, that is extemporaneous, that is just like I would tell my students in jazz history, it's like working without a net. And you really aren't always sure where things are going to go, but you always find a way to make it work. And I think that's a wonderful way to think about it. Well, I'm going to ask you a question, and it just came off the top of my head. It wasn't among those that I submitted to you, so if you don't want to answer it or you're not comfortable answering it, that's okay. But I just have to know, because I experienced this, and I just want to see if anybody else does. I believe that musicians, we think in music, and so we have a synesthetic sort of experience that when we see particular images, colors, shapes, or even situations or interactions between people and animals, between animals, when we look at nature, all that kind of stuff, that we will think in music. In other words, actually hear music in their heads or in our heads. I do. I'm just curious if you share that same sort of synesthetic response.
Yes, absolutely. I always
Okay.
am singing a song in my head, or I feel like a film score is very accurate to depiction of what you're saying. You
Yeah.
walk around and you see scenarios, and then you imagine, what music would go along with that. Yeah, music for me is very much a multidimensional experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I
Yeah,
agree.
I think it's one of those things, we know that music is one of our seven intelligences, but to actually think in terms of, those of us that are musically inclined to hear our musical phrase from some other kind of visual or oral or even tactile stimulus is I think kind of a cool thing, and I keep liking what you're saying about soundtrack, because I used to use that analogy also with my students. I can still remember I'd be teaching the opening to Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, and before I would show them a clip of the ballet, I would say, okay, now, when you listen to this, what kind of scene in a movie is the soundtrack for, and to get the students' responses and get them talking. And it was always really, really quite interesting, and what they would come up with. And then I'd show them a clip on YouTube or something of a ballet performance. And so, it seems like the lay public, and I use that term endearingly, gently, and lovingly, but the lay public, musically lay public, they it seems like today, you can't go to a big concert without there being lots of visuals. We seem to be a very visually attached people. It seemed like, there's got to be the fireworks, flash pots, the giant jumbotron screens and things like that. And I sometimes wonder if that hasn't taken away from, perceptive critical listening to the music, again, because we're telling people what it's supposed to be about through a visual media.
Yeah, definitely. I also think some I was on a talk recently with somebody and they were making the point about how music now is very much a solo experience. You know, people are listening to music in their headphones and people don't listen to music with other people. And that is also so different from how it used to be. It used to be that everybody would gather around and have this shared experience of deep listening together. And how music will be changed by the fact that we all listen to music on our own. And it's been a conscious choice, or something I'm really thinking about, which is having listening parties, having listening parties with other people where everyone's actively listening together. You know, I still have those experiences because my husband is also a musician and we actively listen to music all the time together. But I know a lot of people don't play music in a way where they're actively listening in their homes. It's usually that on in the background when they're doing something else, dishes or cleaning. And there's such a different experience from when you're actually listening to it as the main event to when you're doing something else, like looking at visual art or doing a task or a chore.
I it's really sad because the very thing you're talking, I remember when I was in high school back in the early 70s, my friend Mike and I would ride our bikes down to the local mega drugstore. I guess that's where we bought our records and tapes, and we'd buy some new 8-track, and we'd go back to my house and I'd put it in, and we'd be laying on the floor in my bedroom reading the liner notes and listening to the music. And I'll never forget, I don't mind telling this faux pas on myself, but I'll never forget listening to Elton John's very first recording. And my friend and I both said, nah, he'll never make it. So I guess, hey, you can be wrong, but when you're like, 14, 15 years old, but anyway, but we've lost that. You're absolutely right. There is no, there isn't the listening parties where people would get together and put records on, or listen together. The only communal listening, again, that I can think of recent was, like in a music appreciation class or a music type class in at the university, where you would, everyone would listen together, and then you would kind of pick the piece apart and really kind of get the real marrow out of it, and then go back and listen to it again with fuller understanding. And we just don't do that anymore. You're right. It's become such an individual, I think maybe as a society, we're isolating a whole lot more, and we're getting away from community kinds of things.
I think vinyl players, the resurgence of record players and vinyl, I think that that will help a bit. You know, that my generation, everybody has record players, and just the way you listen to a record, it really lends itself to. You know, it's effort to put the record on there, and then you have to flip it over, and it only lasts so long. Then you have to get another record. It's much different than just putting something on your phone and putting it on shuffle and leaving it. So I do think that I that might have some effect, and I'll be curious to see the effects of that as more people get back into vinyl. But I do agree. I think I wonder how much of an effect it's having on us, the fact that we listen to music by ourselves and don't have this shared experience where, you know, I remember even when I was in college, in high school and college, and there wasn't, you know, streaming services, like you didn't have Apple Music and Spotify and all this stuff. And we all had CDs on our computers, and we would share with thumb drives. We would take thumb drives. If I had a big collection of, you know, Oscar Peterson or something, I would put those on my thumb drive and share them with my friend. And then my friend would give me a bunch of, you know, their music, and I would put it into my computer, and I had all my music on my computer. I would go to the library and get CDs out and listen to CDs from the library. And it was a very conscious choice. It was an action that you had to do, where, you know, making a choice to go find those sources of music. Now it's so accessible. You can hear anything at any moment. It's really changed our appreciation for what we're listening to, I think.
Well, I think there's also an element, and I can't remember where I was reading this the other day, and I can't remember exactly who it was attributed to, but I almost want to say it was Herbie Hancock, who was talking about that in today's music world, the basic listener, average listener, wants their music performed by a celebrity. In other words, we're not so focused on the individual voice as much as the music is associated with a particular celebrity. And I would suggest, and I'm not meaning this in any pejorative sense about Taylor Swift, but I think that's part of why she's as popular as she is because of her celebrity, as well as her music is very meaningful to her fans. I know a number of people who are huge, you know, they're Swifties, and they are huge fans. And I know one particular woman that cuts my hair, she flew all the way from Milwaukee to Nashville just to hear Taylor. And because she couldn't get tickets for when she was in Milwaukee. And so, you know what I mean? But there's a very, but there's something that has to do with the celebrity creating the music. And I think that we often, as a lay public, tend to look at musicians as celebrities. Whereas one of the reasons I was motivated to do this podcast is because, as a musician myself, I know there's a heck of a lot of really musically talented people out there that aren't necessarily celebrities. And they've got as much or more musical talent than the people that are celebrities. Right. And I wanted to find some way, even in my own little way, to champion artists like that, that are making just wonderful music, and hoping that people who listen to my podcast might go, well, yeah, I've never heard of this person, but oh my goodness, you know, this is really, really great stuff. Yeah. But I don't think we're going to be able to fix it. I think we're just going to have to learn how to deal with it. And maybe educate people about it, and maybe try some things. Like you said, with the rise of vinyl, maybe we'll change some things. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask, as an avid composer, are you currently writing anything? And can you share a sneak preview with us of what we might hear on even more future recordings after your new suite comes out in 2025?
Yeah, I've actually taken a tiny break from writing just for the past month or two, so I can try and get this music out. There's the process of between writing the music, rehearsing the music, performing the music, and recording the music. There's a lot of elements and moving parts. Right now, we're really deep in the rehearsal of this because we're recording in a few weeks. So I've been focusing on learning how to play the music that I wrote, because writing music is, a process and takes time. But then you also have to learn how to play the music that you wrote, which oftentimes also takes a lot of time. So I've been working on learning how to play the music that I wrote for the suite, for the recording, and I also have another project, which is my arrangements of the music by a pianist, composer, and vocalist, Lil Hardin Armstrong. And that was recorded in 2021, but is coming out in October 2024. So I've been in the process of mastering that album and working on album artwork and all the behind the scene things that go into getting this music out there into the world. As well as playing a lot of gigs and playing with other people. So I go through spurts. The grant was such an incredible motivator because there's a time frame, and I've never written in a time frame. I always just write when I'm inspired. But that was very much so. They have deadlines and it needs to be done by a certain amount of time. And that was really, really interesting experience for me, because in the past, I've just not been, you know, every day, 2 hours, 3 hours. But when I was writing the music for this suite, I worked on it every day for 2 or 3 hours for 2 months. And half of the stuff I came up with, more than half of the stuff, I threw out. I didn't like it at all.
Sure.
Which is also great. That's also how you learn. So I would love if I had time every day to devote to that, but I'm splitting it between a lot of other things. So I know it's going to come soon, and I'm going to start working on my next project, but right now I'm trying to give that one my all and really learn how to play the music that I wrote.
Well, you know, one of the things that some people I think sometimes don't understand is the amount of emotional energy that one expends in creating art, and especially if you're in an intense sort of, you know, kind of if you're trying to meet a deadline. And so I think taking some downtime is probably well deserved and necessary to recharge your batteries and get yourself ready to go. I think the other thing that's true is, you know, in the music, in all things, maybe not just music, but success is you standing on a pile of your failures, you know, because that's just the way it is. I mean, you know, it isn't always going to be perfect. The moment you write it down, and then even when you get into the studio and you start messing with it, you make changes, you do things differently, you have takes that you keep, takes you get rid of, takes that you glue together to make the perfect take. I mean, and then there's all the other, you know, post-production mastering and all of that. I mean, I have limited experience there, but I have done an album, and I know that it is very time consuming and so forth. So I think that that's something that you're probably well deserved to take a break from and get ready to hit it again.
Yeah. Well,
let's switch gears just for a little bit, because I always like to ask everyone their origin story. Who or what turned the light on for you? What turned you on to music and becoming a musician?
That's a good question. I started playing the piano when I was 5, and my parents had a piano in my house growing up, so I had exposure to the piano. Like when I was less than 5, I would kind of go to the piano and try and play it a little bit. And my dad is a amateur musician, a guitarist and pianist. And my mom studied piano when she was young. So they definitely had an appreciation for music and a respect for it. But I think just being exposed to music in the house and having exposure to the piano, I asked them, can I take lessons? And so when I was 5, I started taking lessons, and I studied classical music, which I now love, but at that time I really did not enjoy it. I was always trying to make up my own things. I felt very pressured by the needing to play everything exactly the way that it was written, and I did a lot of competitions, and I had a lot of anxiety around competing and forgetting things that I was supposed to know by memory. And I remember in a competition, I made up this whole portion of something that I forgot. And the teacher was like, what was that? And I kind of was a preview of what what was to come. So when I was 11, I went to a new school. It's an art school. It's called Arts and Communication Magnet Academy, and it's in Portland, Oregon, where I'm from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they had a great music program and a great music educator named Pharaoh Memory. He was my teacher, and they would bring in guest artists like Fred Wesley and like Janice Scroggins, local people also that maybe aren't well known outside of Portland, but artists that are very well known and respected in Portland. And they would work with us, and I really loved that experience, being able to improvise. He would have me transcribe a lot, and I would learn from records, and I loved the freedom that that gave to kind of make up my own solos. So yeah, that's kind of my origin story, and then it just went on from there. But I will say that my biggest influences when I first started listening to jazz music were Oscar Peterson and Gene Harris, like Ray Brown Trio. Yeah, that was kind of how I got into it initially, was my teacher showed me some recordings of them. And yeah, and I kind of went from there. Then I explored many different avenues.
No, it's interesting. I always remember seems like there's a 2-year college near Portland or in Portland that I always remember had a really excellent jazz program.
Yeah,
And
Mount Hood Community
that's
College.
it, Mount Hood Community College. Yes. And I had a friend of mine that when I went to grad school at North Texas, Paul played trumpet. All of a sudden his last name escapes me, but he was from Portland. And I grew up in Boise, so I'm a Pacific Northwester too in my
Nice.
background. But Gene Harris, when I was at Boise State for my undergrad, he used to play on Thursday nights at the Idaho Hotel because he relocated to Boise kind of later in his life, and we used to go down and listen to him. And then he would do one of his albums is live at Sainte-Chapelle, which is a winery just outside of Boise. It's one of my favorite albums of his. And he was, you talk about a wonderful swinging piano player and a wonderful person. And I wish I'd had my act together a whole lot more when I was seeing him, because I really didn't know who he was and his background and so forth. But we'd go, and listen, and that was really fantastic. But so it was this experience then of going to this art school and getting the opportunity to learn about improvisation, and that really turned you on to jazz, even though maybe you had some sort of inclinations that way anyway, making up stuff on a in a competition. That's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. The music educator, Thera Memory, he was very rooted in teaching about the history. So he had this whole connection, not just history in the United States and the South, and but also in Africa. He connected how jazz music came, specifically like drums and rhythms came over from West Africa, and he had us work with this Ghanaian drummer named Obo Addie that was really well known in the Portland area, and we would have these drum routines that we would do. The school purchased like 25 homemade African drums that he'd made this
Oh
and
my.
we had these chants that we would sing that were from Ghana. And I remember other things, he would play James Brown and have us dance around, trying to get us to feel the music, and very unconventional ways of teaching that also taught us that jazz music wasn't just about improvising and making things up, but also that there was this long history about the blues, and it was created by Black Americans in the South, and like the connection with the history. He also infuse that into the lessons as well, and I was always very interested about that too. So yeah, I think it was partially I was drawn towards improvising, but also it was a very good community of like-minded people around my age that all were interested in the same thing. And also the educator that was kind of leading us was very passionate. So that was also intriguing. And I think about it a lot now because I teach a lot as well now. And I think that if you have a combination of those things, good community and, like-minded people of the same age that can share like an obsession together kind of about this thing that they're all really trying to learn about, mixed with an educator that's really pouring into them and they're feeding off of each other, it can create an environment where, kids thrive. And I've had now as an educator many experiences like this too, where I have students that I feel like were like me. And it's very cool to witness from the other side also this reciprocal mentor-mentee relationship that has been so common throughout jazz music history. The mentor and the mentee relationship is like one of the oldest standing ways that people used to learn jazz music. Come to my gig and sit in and take your horn out and learn by ear and pick up this tune. It was always kind of like that. So I also heavily believe in that, sharing information and learning from each other and like this reciprocal relationship between student teacher.
Well, and as one educator to another, the greatest feeling you can have, I think, is when you see that a student, you see the light go on for that student, when you finally see that they get it and they understand it, and you just, I mean, it's like for me, I used to, it's like I feel like I just made a slam dunk, or I bowled a strike, or I hit a home run or something. It's just that same kind of feeling. And one of the things that I still teach, so I still find very satisfying. When I can get across to people, whatever concept, it's just it's a gas, and it's as for me, it's as much fun as a good night of playing. I mean, it's just very satisfying. Well, that's really you've shared some wonderful background, but in terms of in working as a performer, what are some of the most memorable moments from your career in music?
Wow, I've had a lot of memorable experiences, but most recently, some of the most memorable ones were at last year, 2023 and 2022. My band was selected for American Music Abroad, which is this US State Department tour program. And we got to kind of combine all of my passions, education, traveling, sharing about Black American music, trying different foods, learning about different music and culture, by going to the country of Georgia and Canada. And those experiences, were just very impactful and memorable for me. I love when all the passions that we have kind of cross paths. And I think the older I get, the more that happens. And I am really grateful for that. I love, I've had some great gigs, playing at festivals around the world, in Panama and DR. I've, played in France. I don't know, different places that I've had great experiences. But yeah, I think some of the most memorable are for me are where I'm getting to play with my band. I love being a band leader. That's one of my passions also. Playing my music or arrangements that I've made or teaching about the history of jazz music. Some where there's some kind of bigger concept or theory behind it. Recently, I just came back from the West Coast, I guess a few weeks ago. We were playing in the Bay Area, and there were these very cool two concerts that we played for this kind of hidden concert series. People subscribe to this concert series that they don't know who they're going to see, and they have these pop-up concerts in unconventional spaces like a boathouse in the middle of Golden Gate Park. And the other one was in a plant shop, and they just bring all these instruments out there, and people come to see the show and they don't know who they're seeing. Mm-hmm. And it was very much so a listening space. Everyone was listening. It was so quiet and so intent. And I love moments like that too, that are kind of intimate but unconventional. So yeah, I just had many wide variety of good performing experiences.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And you bring up a really good point. I'm really happy to see that musicians are willing to get out of the concert hall or to get out of the specific jazz nightclub, so to speak, or club, and play in unconventional settings. It's almost like we're taking the music to the people instead of expecting the people to come to the music. Mm-hmm. And it's been a few months ago now, I was interviewing a musician from San Antonio, Texas, and he's a singer-songwriter for an art rock band. But he was telling me about they have a series of concerts in San Antonio where they do concerts under a bridge. And he was showing me, and it's because the acoustic is so unique under this concrete arch and with the water and everything. And apparently it's really popular. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. And then, and you talk about wanting to educate people. I know I play out to every Tuesday night in a little club here in Waukesha. But when I play out, my audience gets a whole lot more than just, here's the first tune, here's the second tune, here's the third tune, because I'm an educator, right? So I have to tell them a little bit about the tune, the history, a little bit about it, that sort of thing. It's just kind of what's innate. Nobody seems to mind too much except, one night somebody from the audience said, "Can we sign up for credit?" And I thought, well, that's kind of funny. And I guess I had that coming. But anyway, yeah, I think those, it's really hard to narrow down the kind of peak experiences that we have as a performer, because it's a gas to play music. There's no getting around it. It's a high. And and we love it. That's why we keep doing it.
Yeah, something you said came to mind, a word that I think would be all encompassing for what spaces I like to play music in. And I would say accessibility to people, all mm-hmm. different types of people. I get very, very burnt out on playing for in spaces that are for wealthy, only wealthy people that have this elite privilege to hear the music, So I think what you said about playing under the bridge, those experiences would stand out to me also, because they're for the public. They're for the people. This music is for the people, mm-hmm. and it should be accessible to the people, for the people. I like the outreach on the State Department tours, because those are all free. They're all public concerts we did them in libraries where mm-hmm. all different types of people, kids and, adults, everybody is there together sharing in this experience that isn't kind of being restricted by a certain demographic or age or income level or, other things.
It never ceases to amaze me. One night I was playing a gig with my traditional jazz band. We happened to be playing a lot of Jelly Roll Morton pieces. And during the break, this one guy came up to me and he says, "Hey, I hear you're playing a lot of Jelly Roll Morton. Are you also going to play?" And he started listing about two or three tunes. And I said, "Wow, you really know a lot about Jelly Roll Morton." He says, "Yeah, I listen to him every day while I'm working at the recycling plant." This is a guy that makes how he makes his living, is working in recycling, but he's got his, earbuds in and he's listening to Jelly Roll Morton all day. And that's, something that, you wouldn't expect, but isn't it wonderful that you could relate to someone that, could hear that music live when they had only heard it in recordings? Or the other thing I love is when, I usually always go out and talk to my audiences during the break to thank them for coming. And people say, "You know, I've never heard music like this before. What do you call it?" And I says, "Well, we usually call it jazz, but we can call it a lot of things. You know, I've never heard jazz before, and I really love it. We want to come back," you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, I feel like I've been a successful missionary for the music or something, you know, that kind of thing. So those are all wonderful kinds of experiences, and I'm glad to see that we're getting to where we're taking more music out to people and that sort of thing. I'm curious to know, who would you say were your models as a pianist?
Yeah, that's also such a difficult question, but I think at different points in my life, I've had different models. And when I first started, I was very heavily influenced by Oscar Peterson and Gene Harris. Then I got deeply into Keith Jarrett, who was also one of my dad's favorite musicians. So my dad had a big influence on that. When I went to college, I got very into Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea. Throughout all of this, I've also studied, a lot of the earlier pianists like James B. Johnson and Art Tatum and Jelly Roll Morton. And I also check out a lot of musicians that aren't pianists
Oh,
also.
sure.
And a lot of musicians that aren't jazz musicians also. I really like gospel music. I like Latin jazz. I like, checking out R&B, hip hop. I think I've had lots of different influences. I still do. And when I was growing up in Portland, when I was in middle school and high school, I listened to a lot of indie rock music, which I haven't kept up with it, so I'm not exactly sure who's current now, but even a lot of folk musicians, Elliott Smith and Ray LaMontagne and people like that, Sufjan Stevens. I used to listen to a lot of musicians like that, and many jazz musicians covered their music too. So there was kind of an intersection there between different styles of music as well.
Well, I know that's, you know, when you tell people that you're a professor of music, and the first one of the first questions people will ask me is, "What type of music do you teach?" And I said, "Well," so I described that, and then, "Well, what kind of music do you listen to?" And I said, "Well, you know, I probably listen to classical music and jazz the most, but I love all kinds of music. I mean, I love, you know, and that's true. I mean, we're always, I think that's one thing, we're always looking for new and different sounds, regardless of the genre. And it's always wonderful to seek different styles and different ways of making music, and because that can inspire yours. Way of making music. Well, then, speaking as a just strictly as a composer, who are composers that you have admired and maybe even emulate?
Kenny Kirkland, Horace Silver, young people. I really like Gerald Clayton's compositions. I don't know. There's so many. Cedar Walton, I think he's a great composer. Duke Pearson, Danilo Perez has been a big influence of mine. He was my mentor, and I really like his compositions. I don't know. There's so many. I'm influenced by everything that I hear. And oftentimes I'll also try and write in the style of a composer that I like. That's a tool that I use as well. So if I hear something and I want to figure it out, I'll transcribe the tune and I'll play it. Then try and figure out what makes this tune unique and try and come up with something that sounds like me, but also influenced by them. Lots of different composers. I studied classical composition a little bit in my undergrad, and learned about different classical forms also. So that has influenced some of my writing. Sometimes when I practice classical music, specifically Debussy and Ravel, I'll take some chords that I come across and I'll just take one chord and then come up with my own thing off of that. So I would say I'm influenced all over the place. Like, it doesn't matter the style or what it is that I'm listening to, but if something stands out to me, I'll definitely pinpoint it and figure out what it is and try and figure out how to use it myself.
Would you say, and again, this is a question I didn't submit earlier, so if you don't have an answer, don't want to answer, but I'm just curious, I want to pick your brain. Do you think that today's musicians, and when I say musicians, anybody involved in music making, either composers, arrangers, performers, whatever, do you think that today in general, we're just a lot more eclectic than we used to be?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think jazz music has become world music to some degree because people all over the world are playing it and they're using their influences from their background and their culture in the music. So then it's changing the music. I think that can be dangerous, you know, in a certain sense, because we have to also, you know, there are some principles that I think this music was built off of, like the blues as the foundation and swing feel and stuff, sometimes being incorporated in some sort of fashion into something that you're doing. Not like I'm not a purist by any means, and my composing does not reflect that either. It doesn't reflect being a purist, but I will say that I think it has become a fusion. It has become a fusion of jazz and hip hop, jazz and Afro-Cuban, jazz and music from the Middle East, or like wherever people are playing the music, there's some connection between the music and their native, you know, music, the music that came from that culture. So, well,
You know, I was really intrigued. I did not watch the Grammys. But I usually always check out the website because I'm curious to see who won in different categories. And I learned this was a category that was completely new to me this year, was one called alternative jazz. And I thought, wow, where are we going here? Is jazz beginning to kind of push the envelope a little bit more? And of course, we know some artists that are definitely doing that. And I guess now it's enough to where it's perhaps a category, but I've always believed that jazz is like a sponge. It soaks up everything around it. And then when you squeeze it, something new comes out, you know, and it's been a very, very eclectic kind of music, with absorbing lots of different sounds and traditions. And I think it's one of the beauties of it. And I agree. I think the idea of the classical composers, particularly Debussy and Ravel, I mean, the harmonic palette that they expanded upon and kind of made normal was really an interesting, you know, change. And to think even as early as like Big Spiderbeck was very much influenced by Debussy, or at least he said he was. In what way exactly, I'm not sure. Maybe he liked ninth chords, I don't know. But anyway, so I think that's always an interesting thing to think about. Okay, well, now I want to hit a little bit closer to home. And you're in your studio at State University of New York Purchase, I assume. Or maybe you're at home. I don't know.
Home.
You're at home. At home. Okay. So, but I've been to SUNY Purchase. I've been on the campus there. It's been quite a few years ago, but you're at home. But anyway, as an educator, what do you tell people aspiring toward a performing career in music?
I would say it's not an easy career.
Okay.
And I would say that that you should make a plan, a 5 to 10 year plan of some things that you hope to get out of playing music, performing music, whatever avenue you choose to take in music. Make a vision of what are your values and what you're hoping to get out of it. I think it's really easy to get caught in a rat race of trying to hustle up the same $50 gigs as everybody else.
Yeah.
And it can be hard to have a vision for the purpose and the point of why you do this. And I think if you don't have a reason why you do it that is very deep and sincere, then it's a very hard life. And if you do have a purpose and you feel called to it, And I think it's great and you should do it. And I think it's a great career. And I think that you can have a very fulfilling life. But I think sometimes people look at musicians and think that, oh, they just do fun things all the time. This is so easy for them and they just do what they love and it's so easy. And I being surrounded by almost 100% musicians in my circle, in my bubble in New York, they're the hardest working people I know. They never take days off. They are constantly working, always thinking about the next thing. Any free moment, they're practicing or writing music or trying to book gigs, or it's just never ending, the amount of work. So I would say just it's amazing, and not to discourage anyone because I think it's great and I love it. I love it. But I would say there has to be some deeper purpose for me, at least. If it was just because I like playing music because I think I'm good at it, that isn't enough for me personally. Maybe for someone else that is, but I would just do it as a hobby if I was good at it and I thought, oh, I'm good at this thing. It makes me feel good because I'm good at it. But for me, I feel like music is a way to connect people. I feel like it's a way to share, to teach about history, to, learn, it's like a way of viewing the world, and it has an impact, a great impact on a lot of people. And that's why I do it. It's for community, for connection, for these deeper things. And if I didn't have that, I wouldn't, it wouldn't mean the same to me. I wouldn't have the same drive every day to do what I'm doing, because you have to be self-driven. If you're not self-driven, it's not the right career for you either. So it kind of takes a certain type of person and personality thing to make it work, to make it sustain.
I think you're absolutely right. I'll give you an example. I've had people ask me what my hobbies are. And I said, hobbies? I don't have any hobbies. I'm a musician. I'm a music teacher. I do this and this and this and this and this. I don't have time. I don't make time to play golf or go fishing or to build, play with model trains. I said, music is my love. Music is my work. Music is my play. It's my everything. Music isn't what you do, it's what you are. And trying to get, I hundreds of students, I used to say, you cannot go into music as a profession as a dilettante. You have to just go all the way in, and you have to know that your work is your play and your play is your work. And if you don't accept that, then you're going to have a hard time of it,
I think
because,
it's good to create boundaries, like I do think that is something that as musicians we should learn to do, but I do agree that it can be very, very hard. I think a lot of times because we're so connected with being what we do is who we are, that concept, it can be really dangerous because it's like if you don't feel good about something that you're doing musically, it can be like, but this is all I have. I've
That's
had
true.
friends that got tendonitis and it was like, wait, I can't do anything else. What do I do now? This is who I am. I have nothing else that I can do. And I think for me, the older I get, the more I'm trying to think about balance in life. So I am trying to some degree to, find a way to, of course, it's not going to be 100% balanced, like a 9-to-5 job, because it just isn't structured in that way. But I do think trying to find boundaries that you can set also is important to teach young people, because it's good to have hobbies. Like, it's good to have things that you like to do that are other than music. That's very healthy. And it also helps you not tie up your entire self-worth with what you do, because there's other things that maybe you want out of life also in addition to being a musician. And I also have those things. You don't know because you can't see me, but I'm pregnant. I'm 7 months pregnant. And having a child soon is one thing I feel like I want to teach my kid that there's balance in life and that there's other priorities besides music too. So I think being an artist parent, something that's new for me, but I think it's really important that we also try and find a way to you know, create balance and work life structure within what we do. We deserve that. We should have that.
Yeah. I hear what you say. And I don't disagree with you at all. I would just tell you that I have a hard time with that still. I'm still struggling with that balance thing. I mean, the one thing I guess I can say I do read a good deal, and I try to not read about music. I try to read other kinds of things. And I think but it's been really hard for me. I mean, it's just like, you know, both my wife and I are supposed to be retired, but we're both still teaching part-time at the university. She does the choir and runs a handbell choir and also a recorder ensemble. And I direct the band and then I also direct another band off campus for older adults. And then I front 6 different music groups that I kind of, you know, and you'd think that that would be enough, but no, last week I get an idea for another band to start. So it's like, it's always kind of
cool because it's your choice, you know.
That's true.
And
it is,
and you, and it seems like you love it, and so that's different. I think a lot of people do it because they have to do it.
That's
because
true.
They don't have enough money to survive, and because they have to. There's right. different ways that we've been conditioned. It's totally, I think, valid. And I, of course, I have a million passion projects that aren't financially, like, they aren't things that I'm. They're things that I invest into because I wholeheartedly believe in them, you know, from a personal standpoint. And I'm sure I will always have that when I'm at retirement age. I'm sure I'll be doing that too. I hope I play until I die. So I'm not saying, I mean, it's great to do what you love, but I just think that we should teach young people that it's good to have balance too.
Well, I think the idea of balance is that, you know, as musicians, and you kind of intimated this a bit, we're a lot into giving.
Yeah.
You know, creating community and giving of ourselves and extending ourselves to others and helping others heal and cope and do all that. And we're very much that. And I think the boundary maybe that we need to find is self-care.
Yeah, definitely.
Those things that give ourselves a good head cleaning and a good restart and a good... You know, so that we don't get too bonkers.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, all right. Well, speaking though of being busy, if I come to the East Coast sometime in the next few weeks, is there a place where I might hear you play?
Yes. All of my stuff is on my website, and I'm trying to think of what you'll have to tell me the dates, and then I'll tell you.
Okay. Well, I'm just kind of speaking semi-hypothetical because I don't have a plane ticket.
Okay.
But if I were able to you know, transform myself and end up in New York in the next couple of weeks, I'm just, you know, trying to let people know where you're going to be appearing and that sort of thing.
I'm playing all the time. I'm playing on Friday at the New School for this Women in Jazz Festival that they're having.
Okay.
I think at 7 to 9 p.m. I'm playing on Monday. I'll put it on my website because I'm going to mess up the location and the time of each of these events. But the best place to follow where I'm playing is social media and my website. So my social media is Instagram. At Kaylee Music, C-A-I-L-I Music.
Okay.
And my website is kayleemusic.com.
Okay.
So I try to keep them both up to date.
I've got your website in my show notes, so any of my listeners that want to access it can to find out where you're playing. And it's good to know that you're going to be playing somewhere in the next few days. I mean, if we could magically... to the New York area, I'd love to catch you and hear you play. But I always like to give guests an opportunity to plug where they're playing soon. So that's great. Well, Kaylee, we're down to the last question. You know, I try to be very thorough in what I ask my guests, so to give them an opportunity to talk about anything and everything they want to, but I know I'm not perfect. So my last question, Kaylee, is there anything else you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
No, I can't think about anything else. Just be on the lookout for my upcoming projects. They're going to be coming out in October 2024 is my Lil Hard and Armstrong album. It's called Bluer Than Blue. And then my suite that I'm writing is that I wrote that we're recording at the end of the month is coming out in 2025. So those are kind of the next two big projects on the horizon. There will be a album release tour happening in the fall.
Okay.
Like October, November 2024, probably. I'm in the process of booking it, but most likely it will be through the West Coast and probably some of the Midwest, mm-hmm. and maybe even some of the East Coast.
Wonderful. Some of
the other states. So yeah, definitely just be on the lookout. If you want to join my mailing list, you can do that on my website also.
Yes. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, you know, Lil Hardin Armstrong used to play in Milwaukee quite a bit.
Yeah,
she used to come out. She would come out from Chicago and would play. Unfortunately, the neighborhood where the clubs would have been, where she played, is now where I-94 cuts through that part of Milwaukee. But it was the old Bronzeville neighborhood of Milwaukee, and she used to come up fairly regularly. And of course, Milwaukee we're kind of in Chicago's shadow. So a lot of times we get artists that are, you know, primarily in Chicago that'll come up this way. And even in the blues area, there was a recording studio up in Grafton, Wisconsin, that Paramount, I think was the name of the record company, used to record a lot of the blues artists that would be in Chicago, and they'd come up. So we kind of have that little shadow here, but that's interesting. So we'll look forward to your recording of Lil Hardin Armstrong's music. That'll be awesome. Well, Kaylee, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with me today, and I want to wish you the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future, and I also want to wish you the best for a successful delivery of your child, and hope that your child brings you years and years of happiness, and that you're blessed with a wonderful experience as a parent.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Craig.
You bet. And you have a great rest of your day.
You too.
My discovery composer of the week is Dmitri Kabalevsky. Born in St. Petersburg in 1904, he died in Moscow in 1987. Kabalevsky attended the Moscow Conservatory, graduating from Mayakovsky's composition class in 1929 and Goldenweiser's piano class in 1930. His first works for children appeared during these years, as did his first major work, Poem of Struggle, in which he attempted to encapsulate the atmosphere and imagery of contemporary life. His Second Symphony achieved considerable success and was conducted by Coates, Gauck, Golunov, Sargent, and Toscanini. It is notable for its heartfelt lyricism and heightened dramatic effect. During the 1930s, Kabalevsky, like Prokofiev and Shostakovich, wrote a great deal of music for the emerging genre of films with sound. Many episodes from his film scores were successful in their own right. The improvisatazia for violin originated in Night in St. Petersburg, while the popular suite, The Comedians, started life as incidental music for the theater. It was during the 1930s that Kabalevsky's style was defined. Although Prokofiev served as a model to a certain extent, Kabalevsky was far less adventurous in terms of harmony and preferred a more conventional diatonicism interlaced with chromaticism and major-minor interplay. The important role played by the subdominant and the frequent juxtaposition of thirds in Kabalevsky's works are in fact features common to many Russian composers. His use of form is conventional. He preferred symmetrical rondo or variation structures. Kabalevsky was appointed senior lecturer at the Moscow Conservatory in 1932 and was made professor in 1939. During these years, he also worked as a music critic. During World War II, he wrote a series of works connected with that event, such as the cantata, The Great Homeland, and the opera, In the Fire, but these were largely unsuccessful. He had greater success with the 24 preludes for piano, based on Russian folk song, which he dedicated to Mayakovsky. These, along with the second and third sonatas of 1945 and 1946, entered the repertoire of a few Russian pianists. The opera, The Taras Family, also dates from these years and concerns the events of the war. Although it was staged in both Leningrad and Moscow, it, like all of his later operas, never entered the repertory. The appearance of the Fourth Symphony in 1956 was a significant event. Its tense and gloomy elegiac style is greatly at odds with the Kabalevsky of preceding years. This lyrical and dramatic vein continued in the Cello Sonata of 1962 and the later song cycles, and it is perhaps significant that these more personal statements have entered the repertory. Kabalevsky's most valuable legacy lies in the field of children's music, not only in terms of the many works he wrote for young performers, but also in his development of a system of musical education for children. Some of his children's songs became musical symbols of the Soviet age, for example, The Band of Four Friends and School Days, while several of his numerous instrumental concertos written for young musicians gained worldwide popularity. Although he wrote a great deal for children's choruses, he frequently wrote for children within the context of a large-scale work intended for professional performance. The forces required for his Requiem of 1962, which was dedicated to the victims of World War II, included a children's chorus. The last 20 years of Kabalevsky's life saw a growing estrangement between him and his composer colleagues due to his unyielding rejection of new music. He concentrated instead on developing a program for music in schools, made appearances at concerts and lectures, and like Kodály and Orff before him, actually taught at a school. These experiences resulted in his two books about music for children, which appeared in the 1970s and 80s. Kabalevsky's traditional stance as a composer and his strong sense of civic duty, which found expression in his education work, endeared him to the Soviet regime. The long list of honors and awards he received, and these include the Lenin Prize of 1972 and Hero of Socialist Labor of 1974, is a testament to his ability to work as a creative artist in conditions under which many others had great difficulties. The All Music Guide lists 7 recordings of Kabalevsky's chamber pieces, 4 recordings of his choral works, 9 recordings of his concerti, 25 recordings of his compositions for piano, 1 recording of his opera Colas Brugnon, 5 recordings of his orchestral works, 4 recordings of his 4 symphonies, and 7 recordings of his vocal music. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video performance of the first movement of Kabalevsky's Violin Concerto in C, Opus 48, with Lung Kin Fung, violin, and Chong Ying, piano. That wraps episode number 182. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I'll be interviewing Minneapolis-based jazz singer Leslie Vincent. We have a great chat about the jazz scene in the Twin Cities and her newest recorded work. Other upcoming interviews include Nashville-based singer-songwriter Ava Swanson, New York City-based jazz vocalist Nama, New York City-based jazz vocalist Aubrey Johnson, and Nashville-based singer-songwriter Laurie Triplett. So don't touch that dial. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog, signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.